Good morning, and welcome back to the Counselor's Cafe, where we focus on the care and feeding of the mind, the psyche, the spirit, and whatever it is that makes us human, conscious of self, capable of change, and free to make choices, whether we like that idea or not. A little psychology, a little philosophy, and maybe a little bit of something else. This morning we're going to have our good friend Paul Nagy back for what is turning into a continuing conversation, which is fascinating.
Yes, I guess so.
Yep, here I am.
Okay. Today we're going to be talking about affect imagery and consciousness, or imagery consciousness with no commas. But before that, I want to invite you to join in the discussion with any questions or comments you may have by calling 929-9601. And if you can't call right now, you can always get in touch later by emailing counselorscafe@nc.rr.com or by writing to Counselor, Box 6, 200 West Weaver Street, Carborough, 27510. Let me know what it is you'd like to talk about. What are your questions? What are your curiosities? And while I'm talking about getting in touch, get in touch with WCOM's website at www.communityradio.coop. Take our listener survey, click on the West End Report to see how you can send us your local mail, explore our program schedule, and keep checking in because we are adding new things to the homepage, to the website all the time, and I don't want to forget that two buttons on there are very important. One is, we may be a 100-watt wonder, but we are webcast around the world, 24/7. Up in the upper right-hand corner, there's a little icon. You click on that, and wherever you are that has internet availability, you can hear us. You can keep the Paris of the Piedmont with you. And up in the upper left-hand corner, equally important, essential as a matter of fact, is the Donate Now button. The only way we can stay on the air at our all-listener-supported community radio station is with your help. That's my plug, which I usually give. I'm going to take a short break and listen to something in blue with Thelonious, and then we're going to come back with Paul and get into this affect imagery consciousness. Okay. A little bit of Thelonious to keep us conscious. Thank you, Thelonious. Something in Blue from his London Collection, Volume 3. Good morning, Paul.
Hi, how's it going, Audrey? I'm happy to be here on this wonderful Memorial Day. And this is also a good time to remember those people of us who have given their lives or had them taken away, actually, maintain our sense of who we are as a people.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a shame that we have to identify ourselves with being this warrior sacrifice of our
right
of our dying. But at the same time, they still need to be honored, whether we agree with war or not. Being a pacifist, I know that my pacifism can thrive when other people are willing to die.
Right.
And fight. Right. For something that I would not would otherwise resist.
Yes, it's one of the reasons why I find it difficult reading the paper lately, or not just lately, in certain sections of the paper as they give the stories of some of these young people who are out there, and they're so young. And I was reading the paper yesterday, and I started to tear up, and I was like, that's it. I know it exists,
terrible. I mean, I know when I was 17 or 18, I didn't think I was so young. I think I was ready to go. But, of course, I was also ready to go to resist the war.
Right.
In Vietnam, my idea of warfare was to oppose it.
Well, that's...
Which was, I was not alone in that in that sentiment. Though I was obviously a little more successful than my friends who also sort of opposed the war but allowed themselves to be drafted.
Right.
And I said, no. I said, the system doesn't have to draft you.
Mm-hmm.
I said, you can tell the system to screw itself. And they didn't believe me.
Uh-huh.
But be that as it may, those are old wounds.
Yeah.
And I think we've done a little better. I think we learned something from the resistance of the Vietnam War is that we're no longer opposed to our troops. We're just opposed to the policies that needlessly have our troops in danger. Or in this case, losing their lives for a policy that, as structured, can't win. We put ourselves in these ridiculous situations. And of course, I wonder about our political system that allows us to, as it were, become held hostage by an executive that that puts us into a war that will not be fully declared by Congress. Except, I wonder about that.
Yes, it is something to wonder about, and it's something as people will frequently get involved with criticizing and getting furious with individuals, without paying attention to the fact that there is a system in operation, and at times specific individuals
the Constitution and the founding document was very clear that an executive was more likely to declare war in a dictatorial fashion than was Congress, and that Congress had to be the body that created war. Now, apparently, since Korea, if not before, Congress has abdicated its full function of putting forth a war, and we might say that Congress isn't living up to its job, at least in constitutional ways, in that this executive privilege of commander in chief fiat, it might be something that needs to be drawn in. Generationally, it may be that Americans, and this means jurists, and also the political, will have to say, no, we have to not be, we're not the policemen of the world. We can't bully our way through things. And have done so, we've impoverished ourselves tremendously. But, as I said, this is Memorial Day, and what we're memorializing about is trying to create a political system that doesn't makes that we will have need to have fewer heroes in the future than we've had in the past. And I know that many of them probably died hoping that they wouldn't necessarily be the heroes that they were.
Right.
I'm actually here to celebrate one of my, I'm a, you know, somewhat of an eccentric. I read books for a living, more or less. And which most people say, it's not wonderful, but you've got to the point where I read way too much and remember way too little. And I have a disease I suffer from. And I've actually had this disease for many years, but I just recently identified it. I don't know if I have the real name for it, but I'm calling it the Big Book Syndrome.
All right.
And what it is that, and I've had this, I've developed this years ago. I mean, I was definitely well as an undergraduate that mm-hmm. I would become completely infatuated with a big book.
Mm-hmm.
One that I recently recelebrated for some friends is a psychological tome that's also an English classic. And a wonderful stylist. It's actually a style I wished I could emulate for scholarship. It was written in 1620 by an Oxford divine named Robert Burton.
Uh-huh.
And Robert Burton wrote this tremendous work in which he attempted to, as it were, filter all of human knowledge into asking and trying to figure out the meaning of melancholy.
Interesting.
Now, a melancholy, as you may know, is a fancy word for despair and mm-hmm. or depression.
Mm-hmm.
And it was probably true that Robert Burton was a depressive.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he was, among other things, a well-known astrologer. And on the day that his horoscope said he was going to die, he killed himself because he didn't want to be wrong.
Oh, my Lord. Is that so?
Well, he did kill himself on the day that he predicted he was dead. Yes.
Oh, my heavens.
He did hang himself. But not after there was 6 editions of his Anatomy of Melancholy, which is this book that I am so happy with, and which everyone
happy with
reads.
A book about melancholy.
Yes, well, there's some interesting, there's some wonderful passages in there. Well, for one thing, he was celibate, so he had the mm-hmm. most nasty things to say about women.
Mm-hmm.
So he was a misogynist down to his mm-hmm. toes. And his misogynistic passages, which is about 100 pages in the book, densely worded, you uh-huh. know, every misogynist that ever pinned ink to paper that had survived into the Renaissance and from the classics is cited
uh-huh.
ad nauseum about, you know, how women, you know, allure
mm-hmm.
and then disappoint
mm-hmm.
profoundly
mm-hmm.
about every aspect of their attributes. And he's much more solid than that.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, so I love this book. You know, he talks about you know, marriage, and it talks about all the things from everything from wedding phobias to marriage to how, you know, every form of friendship. He talks about how friendship is utterly a way of casting you into the depths of despair.
How thick a book is this?
It's pretty thick.
It's about
3. Three or four volumes in the Everyman Library edition, and critical edition from Oxford that came out and is mm-hmm. well out of print is how many pages is that? It's about 4 or 5. Okay. It's about 3 or 4 things. There is a 1-volume edition, mm-hmm. you know, it's a little over 1,000 pages that
uh-huh.
that came out that left out the Latin and what needed to be translated was translated.
Right.
And that's the one I prefer. It's more readable. It's an easier.
Yeah.
It's not as a forbidding text. Mostly, you know, if you see a book like this and you think, what is it?
So that's your disease.
Yeah, this is disease, this big book, you know, and that's an interesting thing. So I'm real enthusiastic, you know, I want to tell everybody, oh, everybody should read this book. Don't let the size, you know, and forever, don't get stuck in reading it from beginning to end. Just open it by, you know, at random and just mm-hmm. allow your eyes to, you know, glaze across the page and you'll find some interesting things.
Okay, now that makes it a little bit more of an approachable thing. If you look at a 1,000-page book and you think you have to read from word one all the way to word end without stopping, it's
your mind would go into the fast freeze.
Right.
You know, it would be the way of draining your draining your transmission of oil before you started on the road.
So this is in a way of just jumping in wherever you want and never really, no guilt in feeling that you haven't read the whole book.
Yeah,
you've gotten something.
And actually there is a there is this multi-page, I think it's 30 or 40 pages outline of the book, of the
mm-hmm.
text, and it's incredibly convoluted.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if anybody's ever seriously followed the outline. There was somebody who actually wrote a dissertation on the outline of the anatomy of melancholy. I mean, just the theory of the outline and how it was evolved. And of course, this is an interesting period, 1620. Shakespeare had been writing, and so you have this really classic, wonderful prose. Not quite as versatile as Shakespeare, but definitely of interest.
So the writing style is good.
Yes, it's definitely an accumulative style. Mm-hmm. In other words, it's sort of he starts and he just adds on and mm-hmm. adds on like a water moving and mm-hmm. moving and moving. And mm-hmm. occasionally you pump into a period, but mm-hmm. you don't have to worry about them. It's almost a stream of consciousness. Uh-huh. In fact, probably the only difference between his writings and stream of consciousness is the periods or in his case, the Latin quotations, which are usually paraphrased. So,
how is this paragraphing?
The paragraphs can be pretty dense. Yeah, that's scary. Scary. Yeah, right. But
so this brought you to your current.
Oh, yeah, current book I want to talk about. Well, one other thing is, so I do Suffering, and this is not the only big book that I like. I have lots of big books, but what caused me to think of this particular syndrome was my latest affection, which is for a psychiatric or psychological tome written by Sylvan Tompkins. Mm-hmm. Now, Sylvan Tompkins is an interesting guy. I don't know much about him except for what I read in the prologue. There is a Sylvan Tompkins Institute, and they're actually around specifically to encourage people to study this book we're talking about, which is Affect Imagery Consciousness. The book was written over a period of 40 years. Mm-hmm. Which is a long time, and it's in four volumes, so you figure about a volume every decade. Mm-hmm. And the last volume was published posthumously and deals with his cognitive theories. Tompkins died in 1991. Mm-hmm. Now, the Sylvan Tompkins Institute is specifically around to encourage psychologists and psychiatrists to read Tompkins' works.
What is the institute comprised of? Who is the institute?
Who is the institute? Well, among them is the guy who wrote the prologue to this thing, which is Donald Nathanson, who's a psychiatrist, and he's the executive director. And we're actually going to be alluding to his prologue in terms of when we discuss the content of this book, more than we're going to be discussing the actual content of the book, which is massive and dense. Uh-huh. This two volumes, so they're oversized volumes, so are well over about 1,200 pages.
Right.
And most people won't read this stuff. In fact, the people who probably most would have enjoyed reading Tompkins' books had died or retired by the time he finished his writings. Mm-hmm. So in some ways, it's a book that missed its time, and it has a lot of there are certain aspects about his writings which would be true for the anatomy of melancholy. It scintillates with ideas, and many of the ideas in Tompkins' books are. Could be actually operationalized. In other words, they could give a clinical or a research psychologist fodder for the the research mill.
Could take like each little section or sections here and there.
Yeah,
and
some of his theories are testable.
Right.
I mean, he tried. I mean, there's a lot of many of his ideas are not testable, mm-hmm. and may or may not hold up as far as the flow of psychological research goes. But many of his ideas are very testable. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is just to know what he's talking about. In itself, would give a psychiatrist or a psychologist, but a clinical psychologist, a wonderful conceptual grid mm-hmm. by which to understand patients, to understand how people suffer, mm-hmm. and to understand where one might be able to intercede in changing that suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll talk a little bit about that. But I want a little bit more about his background. From my point of view, the important thing to understand about Sylvan Tompkins is that he went to school, and he was at Harvard, and he studied with Henry Murray.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Henry Murray had a study of come out about him about a decade or two ago, in which they went at great length about his lifelong adulterous affair that he had. Henry Murray is a very important psychologist in American history, partly because he was one of the people who encouraged Freud and Jungian studies. In fact, he studied with Jung for a while. He belonged to that, you know, upper crust Boston Brahmin background type family. I don't want to completely diss things. And he represented, he had a view of what was called personology, which was the developing theory of what it was to be a whole person. And himself was a very complex, very successful academic psychologist who had this secret life, you know, which is the secret love affair, which, interestingly enough, when he died and they looked at his diaries, was, as it were, this whole other part of himself, which is what the study was about. And I think it talked about it. Well,
this is Murray that you're talking about now.
Yeah, Henry Murray, not Sylvan Tompkins.
And just reading through this, the introduction, I was thinking, as I mentioned earlier, I'm very interested in his psychology, what type of a person he was. The introduction is very interesting in that he talks about, the person writing it talks about his love of horse racing, his picking the horses by looking at the expression on the horses' faces.
This is how he got himself through school. It was by making a little money at the track.
Right. And then getting into what seems to be, and I'm not going to jump ahead, but a rather negative view of existence and human personality. But that's jumping ahead, so we're talking about his background to start with.
So he studied with Henry Murray, and he was a psychologist at Princeton and later at Rutgers. And that was his academic career, was pretty much summarized in that.
Mm-hmm.
And other books, he wrote other books besides Affect, Imagery, Consciousness. But this is his magnum opus.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, the Sylvan Tompkins Institute has been founded specifically to encourage people to read this book. And in some ways, the whole point of my conversation today over the line is the two psychiatrists who listen to this show is I'm saying, well, you should maybe read this book because it might, you know, improve your practice. And you know this is, and I should know because I'm crazy enough to that you know you might be able to understand me better.
About a couple of a month or two from your practice in order to read the book.
Well, this is true, and actually they have reading groups that they encourage at various hospitals. They have like a hospital reading groups and stuff like that, as well as I think they have online courses now that that also encourage.
So you could just reading. Google Sylvan Tompkins Institute and you get all.
And you'll get the possibility of how to network with people. And to be honest with you, they're very clear. The best way to read any book, or this book in particular, is to read it in the context of conversations with others. In other words, to internalize the ideas to a degree. And as that, I think that's one of the things that I find fascinating about it. Now, of course, who is the type of person? I'm thinking myself, who gets all excited about emotions when they can think about them.
Okay.
Yeah, most people want to feel, right? Yeah. You know, that's what I feel. I just feel, you know, just feel, you know. You know, it's this thinking about feeling is sort of like, you know, putting a wedge in the door, not letting it shut or open, one or the other.
Explain that a little bit when you think about feeling. So if you are having a happy moment with a pet, say, you're happy.
Yeah.
The pet's
yeah.
jumping
yeah.
around.
Yeah, you feel yeah, the cat's purring,
right,
and,
right.
I'm just enjoying the sound of the purr, and makes
and
me
then
feel
you start
good.
To think about that.
Yeah, what's the purpose of this? Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And some of us, there are some people who actually enjoy thinking.
Uh-huh.
Now, there are other people who don't enjoy thinking, they think of thinking as a form of anxiety.
Uh-huh.
You know,
right.
Martin Heidegger is one that comes to mind.
Uh-huh.
You know, and therefore, if you think it's because you're not happy with the way you feel.
Uh-huh.
And thinking then is a defense against feeling.
Right.
And I remember, endlessly being challenged in psychotherapy that my thinking was, I was defending against my feelings. I wasn't mm-hmm. allowing my feelings to emerge.
Mm-hmm.
And I was using my thinking as a way to distract myself from, pure anxiety or pure mm-hmm. horror mm-hmm. or pure terror. those feelings that everybody wishes to experience directly without mediation,
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things that thinking is good for, actually.
Yeah, or, maybe pure pleasure. That might be a little scary, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In fact, I'm sure it is. But the, Tompkins' theory of affect imagery consciousness is an integrated theory. And to be honest with you, I haven't mastered this book, so I can't tell you that what I'm going to say about him is totally accurate.
Mm-hmm.
However, I think that there's enough substance in what he has to say that he would be a fun reading because he is so full of insights.
Mm-hmm.
You can't read a page of his without coming to two or three interesting ideas that may have application in terms of understanding how you think or behave, or how other people think and behave.
And that instantly take you off out of the book, because then you start following your own thoughts in connection to it.
Yeah, but so the book is definitely written by as I said, it's a book of genius that and the genius is that it engenders a way of knowing oneself and how others behave in a way that is fresh and new and has incredible possibility. Now,
I want to ask you to jumping into some of his ideas, and I'd like you to talk or like us to talk a little bit about his definition of affect, because affect is generally feeling. But he seems to say affect is physiological response transmutes into feeling, and
it's his biological basis. And he's going back to Moyer's dictum, and I'm actually quoting here that every response is triggered by a stimulus mm-hmm. response mm-hmm. theory, and what he said. No. He says, in real life as lived by organisms, that would mean us, I guess, with affects, no stimulus can be triggered. No stimulus can trigger a response unless and until it triggers an affect.
I
think I think he's talking about something that's more energetic than just the feeling. I mean, the feeling is there, but it would say it's the energetic thing. In other words, we have lots of stimuluses mm-hmm. that we ignore, right? Mm-hmm. Because we're trained to ignore them.
Mm-hmm. We have to if we're going to survive. Actually.
Yeah, exactly, right. And and culturally, we've learned through living life habitually, we've mm-hmm. learned to ignore these stimuli. So the stimulus that we don't ignore is translated into affect, which is this energy.
Mm-hmm.
That leads to response. So what he's saying is that this affect at that level is Emotion is an aspect of affect. In other words, it's the one of the ways that we would read affect.
Mm-hmm.
But but affect is more, you know, is more the selective criteria. And you know,
I guess what I'd like is some synonyms.
Yeah, well, okay, and he has several here actually, and we're going pretty much through the prologue written by Nathus, and then we are going through the book. So, apologies to both the author and editor. The affects are physiological mechanisms easily visible on the face of a newborn, although muted through the process of maturation. They can be easily identified throughout life into senescence. The reader may find helpful the following terminology or affect-related experiences, all of which can be explained in greater detail. The terms affect or innate affect, with reference to a group of 9 highly specific, unmodulated physiological reactions. We're going to talk about those in a second, those 9 unmodulated physiological reactions, are present from birth. We use the term feeling to describe our awareness that an affect has been triggered.
Feeling is an awareness that an affect has been triggered. So the affect is physiological.
Yeah.
So if
and
you're stimulated, and before we got on the air, I was talking about a poking you in the arm as being
that's a stimulus.
A stimulus.
Right. And then I can take that as, are you trying to seduce me or are you trying to get my attention?
Yes.
Right.
Exactly.
That's my script.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Yeah. You know, that's my affect. Uh-huh. Turned into a script,
right.
you know. Yeah.
But that's physiological. That's obviously physiological because there's touch involved.
Right.
Okay. What about a stimulus, a beautiful sunset? Now, you have a physiological response.
Yeah, well, you're seeing, right? You're seeing.
Through the seeing.
Yeah, you're seeing, so that's perceptive. And
right.
That's physiological.
Okay.
Perceptual.
And then your reaction to that would either... where do you get the affect? How does affect?
Well,
then
you're triggering a sense of the beauty.
So you're triggering.
And beauty has all these
certain chemicals in your body that is responding to this.
Yeah, I'm sure that one of the things is that you can add a neurological
response,
psychochemical view to this. Well, okay, so let's take the beautiful sunset.
Right.
You see the sunset.
Mm-hmm.
You're present and you're using your perception of sight and other things, you know,
mm-hmm.
sight and sound and where you are and how
mm-hmm.
you feel physically. So you're not usually, your mind is in what you're viewing, and the viewing of it is paying attention to it. Well, the paying attention to what you're seeing is the affect. In other words, it's because that's you're triggering it, and
but
now you're triggering a sense of
isn't the consciousness that's the consciousness is paying attention. No.
Well, in terms of the energetic sense, the affect is the energy. Consciousness is the way that all the stuff integrates.
Okay.
So let's talk about how.
Okay.
Let's continue with the beautiful sunset.
Right.
So beauty. Which is a profound, multifaceted, multi-leveled, you know, I mean, there's lots of scripture, a lot of scripts, which we'll talk about, which is part of this imagery thing he talks about.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of scripts are involved, and they're all tantalizing.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they all sort of move into mystery and out of mystery. You know, it's both present and not present, both the suggestive mm-hmm. and not suggestive.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of paradoxical, when one is confronted with the mystery and the mysteriousness and the profundity and the
mm-hmm.
simplicity of beauty,
mm-hmm.
right,
and the subjectivity of it.
Well, its subjectivity is an aspect
right.
of it, but you know, but it all it titillates into other, you know, possibilities,
mm-hmm.
which are inspiring. They take us both out of ourselves in terms of how we feel ourselves, and also enthrall us to
mm-hmm.
to a greater sense of. You know, of something that is, you know, sublime. And sublime, of course, means we're on the edge of something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so this, all of which are affects,
mm-hmm.
all of which are, you know, feelings. and all of which are, and they're, but they're a series of layered feelings. And in that way, again, how one understands or has developed beauty, stimulated by the color, mm-hmm. stimulated by the light, stimulated by the juxtaposition of mm-hmm. of, you know, being still enough to just be attentive to the sunset, you know, and not the bee stinging my big toe.
You know, and it's curious that you brought the bee stinging your big toe in because then I'm yeah. jumping into thinking about conditioning. Mm-hmm. So you've got this affect that is a response to seeing beauty of whatever, whether it's a sunset or a flower,
right,
or whatever.
Right.
And then if in there you at the same time smell something terribly noxious, or are stung by multiple bees, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
Then you've got a
that may be another
maybe, affect.
It may be, well, okay, it could be a trigger. For one thing, it may not trigger. In other words, you may be so enthralled by uh-huh. the sunset and its beauty, and uh-huh. so taken with that, so enthralled
notice.
With it, that you won't notice, you know, that you got stung, you know, thereby, in that case, you got a stimulus, but there ain't no response
mm-hmm.
Because there's no affect, because you didn't pay any attention to it.
There's something
now, you might pay attention to it later, but you won't
no,
pay
when that match was lit, there was no gas in the room.
Yeah, yeah. And that's kind of, so we're sort of saying that, you know, so one of the loops, as I talked about here, about, you know, emotion, about what it is, or mood. And a mood, there's also like an attitude. And then there's also what they call the disorders of the moods, which are maybe glitches in our psychophysiology, or glitches in our through our neurotic scripts mm-hmm. that we are unable to feel the affect, and therefore we're not allowing a stimulus to come up with a appropriate response. Mm-hmm. In other words, we can't feel it. For instance, people acclimatized to living in very dysfunctional families mm-hmm. where, you know, somebody's always screaming at somebody else. You know, they become acclimatized to that, and so it doesn't mean the same things, mm-hmm. you know. Whereas most people, you know, yelling at somebody is a form of anger,
mm-hmm.
is a form of assault. It's a style of, mm-hmm. you know, verbal violence.
Mm-hmm.
Other people, they've learned to shut it down. But that's a disorder of mood. That leads to a neurosis. That leads to a diminution of many other stimuli, in terms of this thing. Now, one of the areas where, Tompkins is fascinating, we're only gonna, as I said, ultimately, this is merely a teaser to get you to read the book, because we're really not gonna deal with the book in any fair way. Is his nine intimate affects. So
right.
we recognize that most of these are biologically understood. Mm-hmm. And the first one he has of the nine is surprise startle.
Right.
So, okay, well, let's take the, you know, the infinite infant, right? The intimate infant, the little baby, right? You know, here I was alone in the womb, and suddenly, you know, I'm getting whacked on the behind to make me
right.
breathe, right? That's
right.
a surprise startle reaction, known as the birth trauma.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I'm sure that, that, you know, this is, you know, where there's an increase or a decrease, and something is happening in an intense way, you know? So surprise startle is, you know, and again, it's startle is you haven't made a decision yet. In other words, you're just, mm-hmm. You're surprised. Right,
right?
You're
okay.
You go from.
That's the physiological response.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, so, you know, so so from that innate affect, you have others. And among them are, you know, is the initial one, because you don't know what it is.
Right.
You would feel distress,
uh-huh.
distresses, and anguish. So this
uh-huh.
is the next thing. And this one, as he says here, imagine the next a noxious, steady state stimulus, a mm-hmm. relentless noise, an unpleasant ambient temperature, a physiological discomfort, a hunger and fatigue. You feel distressed,
mm-hmm.
and it leads to anguish, and maybe from anguish to a kind of despair. But we're still actually in the energetic phase.
Mm-hmm.
Despair would be into a script, probably.
Well, basically, because then you get into the, I mean, it immediately brings up stress.
yeah.
This constant assault.
Yeah, yeah, our constant assault. So this was the next aspect of affect. So affects are these little energetic things, a surprise, startle, you know, mm-hmm. boop, here we are. Distress, anguish is endless stimuli, which, you know, is not going away. And this could be a pleasant stimuli,
mm-hmm.
But whatever it is.
Well, if it's a pleasant stimuli, would it become stressful?
It would if it continued unrelentingly. I mean, the most
become less pleasant.
Yes, it becomes anything pleasurable can become incredibly miserable if it persists forever.
A back rub when you have a sore back, and then they're doing it, you know, 3 hours later. Yes, that could be distressful.
yeah, right, exactly, right. Till your skin rubs off.
Yes.
Yeah, okay, that's pretty distressful.
And
of course, then there is another major one, which is anger, rage,
mm-hmm.
and so far we've got, as you were saying, you were seeing this sort of negative tonality
right.
in this stuff.
Right.
These are the stuff that we pay attention to immediately. These are the things that, you know, get our attention. These are our attention getting affects,
mm-hmm.
because they, in other words, they're the ones that engender consciousness, they engender coping, they go from stimulus to not an ignored stimulus to a paid attention to stimulus. So
right,
we pay attention to stuff that comes out of nowhere, it startles us.
Do we move from are we moving because we are pushed by pain or attracted by pleasure?
Yeah.
So
well,
that's
a script,
motion.
You see.
Right.
That's again, we've moved into the script thing, which
right.
is one of his other powerful ideas. The next one is anger, rage. And here you do have a judgment, you know, you've got this steady state of complaint, and it's just too much.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to move.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
I'm sitting here. It's hot. I'm going to go someplace where it's cool.
Right.
You know, get up and move.
Right.
You know, and rage. This could be a very simple thing, because if you're an infant and you're hungry, mm-hmm. and you have the gnawing sense of hunger, you're going to scream,
mm-hmm.
you know, you're going to be angry until you get fed. You know, mm-hmm. you want that, you know, breast, you know, mm-hmm. now, you know,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you're going to let
let your rage be heard.
Yes,
that's
exactly.
How you get a response.
And of course, the next thing is, you know, also when you get the breast, then we have the fourth affect level here, which is a positive affect, which is enjoyment and joy.
Uh-huh.
Ah.
Finally,
I'm being fed.
Uh-huh.
I don't feel that gnawing sense of cloying sense of whatever it was that was bugging me.
Mm-hmm.
I feel this is good. This feels safe. I, you know, sucking away. Everything is okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is enjoyment.
But when he's talking about it here, and I'm looking at it,
mm-hmm.
where he says, easiest to grasp is the effect or affect responsible for laughter, the feeling of relief, the sense of whew when a challenging situation ends, or the joy of victory. And in reading through this, even though he says that is the easiest to grasp, perhaps in the book he goes beyond that, where enjoyment and joy is not necessarily restricted to humor.
Right.
Hopefully in the book he goes into it a little bit.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I think there is an incredible emphasis here on what we might call the negative affects.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, of the nine affects, you have enjoyment and joy, and then another one which is a little more neutral,
mm-hmm.
which is interest and excitement.
Right.
You know, which, yeah, it doesn't, that's, you know, interest and excitement sort of sounds blasé, you know.
Well, you know, it's not exactly blasé, because if we are not interested in things, and I get into this sometime in research about curiosity, what makes human beings curious, mm-hmm. That's one of the problems with our aging population and Alzheimer's and all sorts of things. If people can't
losing
interest.
Yeah, and with losing and not being able to become excited, you know, like,
right.
See, I'm excited about this book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I'm trying to convey my interest in this book, and I'm excited about it.
Mm-hmm.
So in some ways, I'm thinks to actually.
I think that's a section. When he gets into that, I think I'd like to read that section.
Yeah, he says, for instance, and I'm going to quote a little bit here. He says, "Recall for a moment Thomas' basic premise about the affect system. Advanced animals cannot survive as individuals or as a species unless they are able to, one, select whatever turns out to be the most important source of information available at any moment, and two, develop the best method of handling that information, and three, manage systems for the retention and immediate access to what is so learned. Interest, excitement... is the genetically scripted protocol that mobilizes attention to information that enters our neurological system at the optimally increasing rate of stimulus acquisition."
Mm-hmm.
Now, you see, the thing about Tompkins is that he's always biologically based. He's mm-hmm. always involved with the stimulus affect response, this mm-hmm. energetic mode, but he's always seeing it in a holistic way
mm-hmm.
that it is related to imagery. So you mm-hmm. have affect, which is the energy, and the imagery is these protocols mm-hmm. that are innate, which give us ways of coping with the world. In other words, they are the way we learn, you know, to speak language is one of the ways that human beings develop language as a means of as a script.
Mm-hmm.
And then with this script, we develop stories, you know, and the stories are the way we manage our emotions. It's the way we tell when someone is smiling at us, whether they like us or they're grimacing at us and mm-hmm. they really hate us. See? Now,
well,
we may not
laughing at us.
Yeah, they're laughing at us. And we'll have to, so we have scripts to go with those. Mm-hmm. I mean, the stimulus may seem very similar, but we have ways, true and false, you know, each of us develop ways, true and false, that interpret these stimuli mm-hmm. along various scripts, many of which we interiorize long before we get around to thinking of what an affect is versus what an image is and what our whole consciousness is. But it exists in its totality.
So in a way,
and it
as
becomes
we go
more
along,
complex and the same time is still based on the same simple stimulus. Do we have a response?
So we go along step by step by step, and each step we are designing, constructing the prism through
yeah.
which we interpret the world.
Yeah. So in part of so one of the geniuses is that he's a constructivist, which mm-hmm. is a form of psychology that's very popular. But he's a constructivist that is always clear about his limits,
mm-hmm.
and the limits here being our biological limits, and also the limits of our. Of our system of affect, that affect is sustained, but only sustains within a certain
mm-hmm.
and within a certain range. It can be prolonged, perhaps, which would be the interest excitement mm-hmm. thing, or would be distress anguish mm-hmm. is a way of prolonging a stimulus that we don't mm-hmm. want. But the The next one he talks about, and it's, I think it's more interiorized, but also is part of this system, is fear, terror.
Yes, we get back to the negative. I'm going to
yeah.
psychoanalyze this person.
Yes, yes. Well, and then one of them is ones that is I found the stimulus is in volume 3 mostly, which is the protective mechanisms of shame and humiliation. Actually,
mm-hmm.
volume 2 mostly.
Mm-hmm.
is shame and humiliation system is incredibly developed. And and it's because it's used incredible. It is a system that is used in our educational system, mm-hmm. and it's used in our status system, you know, mm-hmm. whether we're accepted or not accepted, mm-hmm. Deals with a sense of shame and humiliation.
Mm-hmm.
It's also one of the ways that, in some ways, we have the most difficulty managing, and probably mm-hmm. it's where our own society could learn to use it less.
Mm-hmm.
We would make healthier, happier, more cooperative people
mm-hmm.
if we used the shame humiliation system less than we do, and also the fear terror system. You know, the fear of terror system, that, for instance, in our own society is, you know, you're going to end up being a bag lady, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're going to end up being homeless, or you're going to, if you have no money, you're going to be out in the street. Nobody, mm-hmm. you know, that's a terror scenario.
Out in the street.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. the terror scenario
mm-hmm.
that, you know, exists in our system. Well, of course, we use it as one of the ways, I guess, to keep us wage slaves of one sort or another.
Yeah, of course.
To keep us on the treadmill of our
raise our children that way. You touch that again and I'm going to smack you up the head. So,
yeah.
Anyway.
And then...
But the shame and humiliation, I mean, I think immediately of the shunning, where in earlier societies that's how they got people to conform to the social norm, is if they didn't, nobody would look at them or acknowledge their existence.
Yeah, and the and then there's number 8 and 9 are actually dealt with less. I have a very good idea of what they represent, but 8 and 9 are called the drive and a luxury. What's that word? How's that pronounced? Auxiliaries of dismal and disgust. Dismal and disgust. Well, dismal is...
What is dismal?
We're going to find out right now, because it's a neologism coined by Tompkins. Makes us reject potential foodstuffs that carry an odor outside of certain rigidly determined limits.
So he's really talking about smell.
And taste.
Okay.
From early beginnings of extrauterine life, such substances trigger programmed reactions. These include wrinkling of the nose, the upper lip, backward movement of the head away from offending odor, and the vocalization of the enough.
Uh-huh.
So powerful. And similarly, foodstuffs has triggered taste outside the narrow range of acceptability is with disgust. So, you know, and then, of course, what is UGG? You know, this mechanism forms the basis of another script through which a person can experience once found delicious is now declared to be disgusting and worthy only of expulsion.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see those two, well, at least in this prologue here, they're not too well developed.
Right.
But at least they, you know, what he's trying to do is, I think he was trying to stay congruent with the way we process through our senses,
mm-hmm.
too.
Mm-hmm.
And last but not least, in a very summary way, since we're running out of time.
Yeah, we're getting there.
Is Tompkins' blueprint for an individual mental health. And it was a little very simple view, which is, as humans, we are motivated to savor and maximize positive affects. In other words, stuff we enjoy, mm-hmm. what feels good, and what we can find and maintain more of it. 2, we are inherently biased to minimize negative affect. In other words, mm-hmm. if I don't like it, I'm not going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
3, the system works best when we express all of our affects. Now, here's this, what it says is one of the problems is the system doesn't work when some of our affects have been squelched.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, when, you know, somebody isn't allowed to express fear or terror,
right.
you know, or is overly invested in shame and humiliation.
Or one perhaps if you're never allowed to express joy.
Yeah, joy. You know, joy is something that you're as grimaced upon.
Or I'm thinking, you know, the stiff upper lip.
Yeah. So anything that increases our power to accomplish these goals, which is to positive affects, is good mental health. And anything that reduces our power is bad mental health.
I guess what amuses me about the whole thing is that it took them 4 volumes to get there.
it's a simple system, but as I said, for him, the beauty of the book, which we really haven't been able to convey in a lot of ways. We didn't
Except
talk any great about the script,
wealth.
The theory of scripts, which deals with imagery and how we develop it. The therapeutic disassembly of scripts, the various disorders of affect, which he goes into a great deal, because you have to remember he was writing when psychology was primarily concerned with disease and the curing of disease. Cyclic changes in the public display of affect. So affect is both, you know, shown and hidden, and this can have ways of things. And then last but not least, his theory of cognition, which comes out in his fourth volume of the system. So the whole point of this show is to say that if one is interested in psychology, if one is interested in having a way of thinking and understanding how our emotions work and wants to think about that and to understand that either as a working psychologist or psychiatrist or just as a curious person, then I suggest that you take the time to look at affect imagery and consciousness, and if you really want to read it, probably read it through the Sylvan Institute with other people who are also reading the book, so you can discuss the ideas and hash them out.
I think the idea, and we really didn't quite get to it, and we probably don't have time, is the fact that this is the origins of consciousness. And consciousness is what we're all into these days, is, you know, what is conscious and what does it mean to be conscious? And he's saying it's, we develop our ideas because of physical stimuli.
Yes, this is definitely a biologically based system of consciousness in which our affects, which are those are the stimuli that we pay attention to, evolve
originally
through imagery, which are the stories we tell ourselves and our metaphors, that and that all of this is bundled in a thing, a feedback system, a loopback system of cognition and feeling and emotion that is consciousness. And in that bundle of energy, we are in the process of knowing who we are. And with Tompkins, it's full of wonder and excitement of discovery.
Okay. And I'll put what I said to you earlier was, instead of I think, therefore I am, it's I am, therefore I think. Okay.
Definitely
almost.
Tompkins
in a shorthand.
was a rabbi of the mind.
Right. Right. Thank you so much, Paul. This has been fascinating, and I do hope you come back again because we have great conversations. At least I enjoy them. And Rocco's here, nodding his head. Okay. Tune in again next week for the Counselor's Cafe. And tune in tomorrow for Touchstones with Paul Nagy at 11 o'clock.
Yeah, we're going to have a poet on, and we're going to be talking about his views of his poetry and also his own religious quest, which is quite good. This is going to be a nice show, and Max is a great guy. Max Preston is a great guy, and we'll have a nice conversation.
Thanks much. Bye-bye. Stay tuned now.